This episode of Unquasi Unfiltered is brought to you by MTN Zambia. There's no us without you, so we say thank you.
Welcome to Unquasi Unfiltered. This is your go-to podcast for all people of great interest here in Zambia. We've had people across an entire spectrum of industries, bankers, financial experts, culinary experts. But today we have a special treat for you because we have a gentleman who is known for being on set, albeit behind the camera. And so the treat is that we're actually going to have him in front of camera and under the spotlight for a change. His very brief resume, we've had to abridge it because it is quite lengthy, is he's a man who brought us Zambia's very first official soap opera, Kabanana. He's also been the man behind the legendary Makofi. And as if that's not enough, he was part of the team that brought us Zambia's first Netflix offering, which was something that we'll talk about a little later, but All in all, he's a man who's had a very storied and legendary life in front and behind the camera. This man, of course, by now is a man that you know as Mr. Lawrence Thompson. But to some of us, Uncle Lawrence, welcome to Unquasi Unfiltered.
Thank you very much, Kamisa. Really honored to be on this show.
It's wonderful to have you here. And I know we've had to battle to get you to sit in front of camera, but we're glad you're here. And we know that we'll learn lots from you. Now, for a lot of people, we basically just ran into you as Uncle Lawrence. And, oh, okay, and had no clue where you came from. You were just always there. You're just this beacon who showed us true north in the creative space. I know there are a lot of people who are curious, just as I am, about your history and your background. Please tell us a bit about where you were born, how you were raised, and also, as we segue from that, just highlight what sort of upbringing you had and the way that influenced the adult that you are today.
Yeah, I was born in Thorn Park. Back then, it was called colored quarters. You know, at that time, Zambia was under colonial rule.
Right.
And there was segregation in the country at that time. So I happened to have been put in an area called Thorn Park, which was for colored people only.
Right.
And it was a complicated place that I was born in. I was born in a family, seven in the family.
Right.
Three boys and four girls. And growing up in Thorn Park was quite a complicated thing. And, coloreds come from a white background, and black background, or Indian, whatever.
Right.
But offspring of black and white parents is not straight away white or black. It's sort of like in between. And then sometimes you've got lighter chips and then darker chips.
a whole spectrum of color.
Yes. Yes. And during the colonial era, it was the darker people would be like sort of like even within the colored community, there was that kind of segregation in there. And if you look at my skin, I'm black, dark. and it wasn't easy as a young boy in that kind of environment. My friends had blonde hair, blue eyes, some of them, and so on. So you were always like put at the side and growing up with that kind of thing because you didn't know where you belonged, you know.
It was
quite complicated at the time.
And how did that influence you? How did that affect you?
I think when you're brought up in an environment like that, you want to excel. You know, you really want to prove yourself to say that I'm not just nothing. You know, you're always trying to be to push yourself and things like that. You know, I think that being in that sort of like a position made me want to do things, and I think it also made me creative and always try to do things differently from what everybody else was doing.
Right.
So I think that's what influenced me to be in the creative sort of industry.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And in You highlight the fact that there was a lot of segregation and you were treated a particular way because of your skin tone. But I'm hoping there were a couple of people who still instilled a lot of self-belief in you.
Yeah.
Who were those people?
I think it's Thorn Park School. We had some white teachers there, and just getting into Thorn Park School was also complicated. You must know that, like, for example, if your hair was a bit kinky, and when you're going into the school to prove that you're colored, you had to put a comb through your hair.
Wow.
But obviously parents were quite smart. You cut the hair very short so that...
comb has nothing to cling on to, right?
Yeah. But I had a teacher called Mrs. Singh.
Hmm.
Yeah. And she just, out of the... I was the darkest in the class, but she loved me the most. And she also used to inspire me. So I think that's where I got that. She was the one who inspired me most. Growing up, and then later on, I did get other people who mentored me and were influential in my life. One of them is my late brother-in-law. He was from Jamaica, but he came to Zambia and used to play for a band, a very popular band at the time called the Migs. And he didn't know about the segregation because where he came from, it's either you're black or you're white.
Right.
There wasn't a middle.
No middle ground.
Yeah. So he also inspired me. He taught me how to box. So as a boxer, So as a boxer when I was young, and he's the one who taught me that. And boxing also brings something out of you. It's there's a discipline that that it comes with, and through boxing, I started looking at other inspirational characters like Muhammad Ali. He was like somebody I looked at, and I. And whilst doing boxing, I used to, you know, get all those boxing illustrated books. I don't know if you, magazines and stuff like that. And I knew so much about boxing because I was really into it. And so those were some of the people who inspired me and helped me build confidence in myself and move in the direction that I wanted to go. Yeah.
That explains Makofi. The behind the scenes was a bit too detailed for an outsider. You definitely have made your way around a couple of boxing rings.
Yeah.
With that said, in school, which subjects did you excel in? And I know you've highlighted that, obviously being sidelined and sort of ostracized, you tried to excel and strive and to be the very best at what you did. Which subjects were your go-to subjects?
In primary, obviously, it was social studies, civics, and stuff like that. I wasn't really into maths and things like that. I enjoyed history. That was during my primary school time. But as I grew older, I went into, when I was in secondary school, I started getting into literature. I read all the African Writers series and, you know, all those interesting type of books. Right. So I was into literature, history, geography. Those were my subjects. But I also had a slight leaning into biology and technical drawing. Those type of things, yeah.
And what kind of a student would you describe yourself as?
In primary school, I think I was dull.
Oh, that's blunt.
But I think I was just playful, not really dull. I think I was quite smart, but I didn't really concentrate on the studies and things like that. And I just loved playing with fireworks and things like that. I mean, I was crazy for fireworks, and and that took me away from school and all that. Right. But when I concentrated, I mean, I would get high positions in class. But I wasn't the best student in the class.
Right.
But yeah. Not dull. I just
did apply yourself as now, you should have.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And you've highlighted some of the subjects that you really enjoyed, but which one really brought out your creativity? Were you, aside from the classic subjects that we're taught in school, did you identify some form of creativity, drawing or art, drama, or something to that effect?
I was always involved in drama. The unfortunate thing, at primary school, I didn't do much drama.
Right.
But I enjoyed acting. I enjoyed doing stuff like that. And I used to, when I was quite young, I sort of like used to try to do plays, you know, just little storytelling kind of things at home and stuff like that.
Right.
I don't know if you remember the candle cinema we used to do where you cut out images.
Little images and then run the shadows.
Yeah, yes. That kind of thing. I used to do that quite a bit. And then there was one time when I discovered, you know, these magnified mirrors.
Right.
So I'd have people playing outside the house and take that mirror and, you know, reflect it onto the wall just below, and you could see the people.
So your first homemade CCTV.
Yes, that's what it was. I started writing also quite a bit during that time. And that was also through the literature class that I was doing. During the holidays, I joined a drama club called Tikwiza Theatre.
Right.
And I acted in one of the thing, A Raisin in the Sun. Quite a young age. I was voted one of the best actors.
Oh, that's a classic. A Raisin in the Sun. That is a classic. And which secondary school was this you were at?
Nkumbi International College.
Right.
Yeah.
Amazing. So once you discovered that you had this ability to tell stories, was it an aha moment as to what you wanted to become? Growing up, when you said, okay, this is it, I'm going to be a storyteller. Well, how did you transition into that?
In spite of all those things, I wanted to be a doctor. In spite of, you know, the creativity and all that.
Really?
Yeah, I wanted to be a doctor. But, you know, I believe that when there's a calling for you, somehow you're led to it.
Right.
I knew at the back of my mind I was creative. I knew how to write and all those things, but I wanted to be a doctor. So when I got to Nkumbi International, let me just give you a background from thing.
Sure,
I didn't qualify in grade 7. I was out of school for about 2 years.
Really?
Yeah. And then Nkumbi International College was a college which was specially created for Zimbabwean and South African
freedom
refugees.
Fighters. Right.
But they also had an opening for Zambians.
Right.
So I was able to get into Nkumbi International School. And there I got into the photographic, there was a club for photography, and I was taught how to do all sorts of photography, and I started falling in love with photography.
Oh, wow.
But still, I wanted to be a doctor.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know, there's a silly nature in me that I thought I was doing my parents a favor to go to school. So when I...
They owed you.
Yeah, they owed me. Yeah, so when I came on holiday once, my shoes were done.
Right.
And I demanded my mom, I went to my mom and I said, I'm not going to go to school if you don't get me a pair of shoes. And I better get them before I go. And I didn't know what pressure I was putting my mother under. So just before I was going, I said, I'm not going back to school and so on. And she went to work and came. And she came home one day from work, very tired, and she was carrying the plastic bag. And she looked at me and she says, I've got a surprise for you. And she pulled a bag and then showed me there was a pair of shoes in there.
Oh, wow.
And I got the shoes and looked at them, and I was so disappointed. They were plastic shoes, and I threw them on the ground and said, these are rubbish shoes. And I walked off and I went into the bedroom. And then I looked out, and my mom looked at the shoes, and she picked them up. I was looking at them, looking at her, and I felt so guilty.
Mm.
I felt so silly, and you know, I actually broke down and cried at that moment, and thought, what a horrible son I was.
Yeah.
And I just gathered myself, went out there, and I said to her, sorry, these shoes are actually so nice. I don't know why I'm so silly and all that. And she says, you see, I told you, I don't see why you're making such a fuss. And I took the shoes. But I made a vow that day that I'd never, ever get my mom to buy me another pair of shoes or to pay for my school fees or anything.
Mm.
And I went flat out into the photography. And I decided every time I was on holiday, I was going to find a job. And then I found a job with a company that was actually doing news. Yeah. News thing, and I joined them as a cameraman, for Reuters Television, which is now Viz News, which is now Reuters Television.
Right.
And I started doing television news for American station CBS and all those things, but it was only a holiday and part time job.
Right.
But that's when it caught me, and I said, "This is what I want to do."
the bug bit you and just never let go.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. And so obviously we belong to a culture where there's a lot of folklore and traditional stories, and oral tradition is a big part of who we are as Zambians.
Yeah.
Were there any particular stories that you heard that influenced you? And who told those stories in a way that you visualized them and that maybe that influenced who you are as a storyteller?
Again, it's my mother.
Really?
She used to tell us, you know, back then we didn't have TV, so there's a lot of storytelling before we really got into TV.
Right.
And my grandmother also was a very strong influence on TV. I don't know if you heard this thing where they say, Panali Panali?
Yes.
That's what my grandmom used to open up stories and tell us stories.
Oh, my goodness.
And there were so many stories she told us. Some of them I actually use into some of the films that I've written, although I haven't yet produced them, but I wrote them because of the folklore stories that I was told by my grandmother and my mother.
Right.
So they also had a very strong influence in terms of telling stories.
Amazing. There's such a wealth of material that is inherent in our folklore.
Yeah.
And the late Hugh Masekela said, the secret of my success, and he's uttered these words in an interview, he says, the secret of my success is I build on what resonates with people.
Yeah.
If there's a traditional song, I go off and adapt it.
Yeah.
Because a person will wonder why they've fallen in love with it. But it's because it takes them back to a place, a long gone era.
Yeah.
They're sitting around a fire again and they're listening intently to this story as it's unfolding.
Yeah.
And clearly it's a gift that creative people possess, creative people such as yourself. Now, obviously the influence of film and motion picture then led you into what you do today.
Yeah.
But how accessible were movies and films and television when you were growing up?
It was very difficult. For me, making the film decision to really start going into filmmaking was when I worked as a cameraman behind the scenes for the film Cry Freedom. Richard Attenborough was the director, and they, Marble Arch Productions, hired me to film behind the scenes.
Wow.
So I was actually filming with her and sitting and talking to Sir Richard. We spent about 2 weeks as he was doing all the research and auditions. And, you know, the downtime, he would talk so much about the films and so on. So that influenced me quite a lot.
Right.
And even the type of films that Sir Richard Attenborough did influenced me quite a bit, because he only did true life stories.
That's it.
So for me, that's where my leaning is. Even today, I like to tell stories which are drawn from a real real life rather than fictional type of stories. So that's why you saw Can You See Us? I wrote it.
Yes.
Because when I heard the story, I said, "This I have to make a film
story that must be told."
Yes.
And gratefully, that story has been told and told well. And we suddenly have a glimpse into the difficulties of a child growing up with that condition in Zambia. And this is, we're oblivious of that information prior to that.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd hear a story here and there, but to see it in such graphic detail, the rejection and the pain and what that was used as fuel for this creativity to gush forth. Truly a masterpiece. I may or may not have cried when watching it.
I cried.
Hey.
I cried writing it, so I'm sure.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I fully understood. It's a very well-told story. If you can recall, which was the first film or story that captured your imagination and had you in awe of the movies and storytelling through that medium?
I think the most impactful film for me was Gandhi.
Gandhi, yes.
Yeah. Although at the time I didn't know who the filmmaker was, but when I watched it, I was really moved by, you know, his peaceful struggle and things like that. So that was the one film which impacted me quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, there was one film which I think even when I did get to fall in love with filmmaking, I think that's one which also sort of like stood with me. It was called Love Brewed in an African Pot.
African Pot, yeah. right.
It was one of the first African films, and it did the rounds all over Africa, and and it was such a beautiful film. It reminded me of so many different stories, you know. So I think that one also did impact me quite a bit.
Amazing. And all this just gelled together to form your drive to tell stories. Now, what would you say would be your biggest motivation to want to tell stories?
I think trying to enlighten to enlighten people on some of the things that are, you know, the voiceless, creating a voice for the voiceless and things like that. That's what really motivated me to want to tell stories. Earlier in the day, I was really trying to tell a story because a friend of mine, this cross-culture kind of marriages and stuff like that.
Right.
I was quite young then. I wanted to do a film, and then I met Edem Jokoto.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
You know, the challenge is when you want to do some of these things, and Edem was so motivated when I read his story. It was about a Zambian guy who was dating an Indian girl, and the Indian brothers attacked him and so on. Beautiful story.
Mm. Mm.
And this film, similar film, went on to be made, Mississippi Masala. It was exactly
that's
that
same story.
Yeah.
Right.
But at the time, I was young and naive, and I thought I wanted to make this film. And these are some of the challenges you face when you want to do some of these crazy things. And I called some of the people in the industry, the gurus in the industry. And I said, I'm going to make this film. And, you know, with a little knowledge I had, and I called them all and I was addressing them. I said, I've got this film and I'm going to shoot it. I started talking very naive, thinking that's the way you're supposed to pitch to a, you know, and I learned a lesson on that day, because somebody really told me a thing or two, and it discouraged me from making films completely.
Oh.
And there was a bit of bitterness and all that. And I shelved filming completely. But those are some of the challenges which I faced, like, when trying to make some of these movies.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. There's no us without you, so we say thank you. And so when you've eventually figured it out and decided, this is it, this is who I am, this is what I'm going to do with my abilities and my talent, what sort of doubts and pressures came from friends and family? Were they supportive, or did they say, nah, filmmaking in Zambia?
Well, there was a lot of negative people not believing in it and so on. But I think I'd made up my mind I was going to make the film. Obviously, family, my wife wasn't really for it.
Mm.
Your aunt,
she wasn't
for it, and she just kept away from it. But I put everything I had into it, in spite of all those things. But people don't think that there was anything in making films. You know, it's like, where are you going to go with this?
Right.
I pushed on until we got to do the first episode of Kabanana, which we pitched to the business community. And from that day, everybody was like, wow, we didn't know we could do this in Zambia.
It can be done.
Yeah. And then the changes started happening and people started appreciating it.
Hmm.
First calmly, you know, like cautiously and so on.
But
later on, it was like, wow, this is really good. And they started supporting. But there was a lot of naysayers, negative people. And my wife supported me, but she had grounds to do that because it took our savings, and we're pumping into into doing it, and it left us in quite a difficult time, because at the time, you know, ZMBC, nobody was buying films. You had to pay for the spot on TV,
correct,
and try to make your money from advertising and things like that. So it was very difficult, because our budget, instead of it just being production budget, it had to be production and placement.
That's
it. Because there was no distribution, you know.
Oh my goodness! And finally, things came right. And are there any fond memories that we may not have been aware of with Kabanana? Funny moments that occurred with either writing of the scripts, cast members not figuring out what they're actually supposed to be doing. Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, I mean, you must know that most of the actors didn't know what they were doing, and they thought like acting was just a straightforward thing. But you know, you got to do a take after take.
Correct.
And you find people getting frustrated. But you didn't tell me it was going to take this long, you know, stuff like that. And then there were incidents where, for example, I don't know if you know Uncle Patrick in Kabanana.
Yes.
He was such a funny guy. And one day I remember that we're doing a funeral scene, and because they thought Mr. Kabanana had died.
Right.
And he kept on singing a song, and he says, the Pajero is mine, I'm taking it, you know. And Pakeni stood up, the Pajero, and you know, it was such a funny moment.
It became an improv scene.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I was on the monitor watching it.
Right.
And I was looking at the you know, before I saw what was happening, I was looking at the viewfinder. And then I could see the camera was going like this, and I looked at my cameraman and he's laughing.
He was in stitches. Oh.
And then everybody broke out into, and from that day, we couldn't shoot the whole day. We couldn't shoot, and we had to cancel the shoot for the day and do it the next day.
Oh, no, fantastic moments. I think probably everybody got into character and they gelled and they stayed in character extremely so.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. And your thought process in terms of telling a story, do you have it all locked in, including cliffhangers, or does that evolve? Is that some organic process where you start with a skeleton and then starts fleshing itself out? How does that work?
Yeah, okay. It depends on what you're writing. I once had somebody interviewing some very talented musician, and somebody asked him, how do you get the process and all that? And he says, I don't know what the process was. I don't know what happened. But at the end of the day, I find that I've just written the whole, you know, all the lyrics of the song and it finishes. Right. I find that there's a flow which just comes when you start writing. It's like it's all there and it's just poured out onto paper. And at the end of the day, you look at it. I mean, it took me some scripts take me like 2 weeks. Like I wrote Can You See Us in 2 weeks. And I never stopped writing. I just got in there and it was just coming out and all that. Everything was being worked out, but the flow, I couldn't understand how it was coming. It's like you know, God works in a way where he just gives you the talent and it just comes out. And sometimes you ask yourself, is it me who wrote that? And you know, because it's like you're not, it's like you're detached from the writing. It just pours out, you know.
Amazing.
Filmmaking
has come a long way from when you first started out. And how did you overcome the challenge of equipment? Because I know for you to be able to shoot to a standard that can be televised or can go onto the big screen, equipment was not as accessible as it is today. We still have challenges now, but it's a lot easier. You're able to rent equipment. But how did you overcome that? How did you manage?
Yeah, that was a challenge. I mean, if you saw my first boom, you've got all these contraptions now. If you saw my foot, it was actually a broomstick.
Oh.
And then for the windshield, I got wire mesh and covered it with
foam. Oh.
and that's what, you know, we should have actually created a museum of some of the stuff we used.
Yeah. Yes.
Our tripod was welded. You know, we welded the contraption and put wheels and stuff like that. It was, it was really, really hard. But the camera we were able to hire because Tebeta used to have equipment.
Right.
So we used to hire that equipment from them, but everything else you had to figure out because we didn't have all these C-stands and all those.
Nah, you MacGyvered it.
You MacGyvered it. and it worked, you know. Even our lighting was just ordinary flood lamps and things like that. Yeah, and
it took a while. No temperature issues.
No.
You got what you got.
Got what you got, yeah.
It was a tungsten halogen tube. That
yes,
was what you got.
That's what you got. And yeah, it was. And the sound used to be quite a challenge. We never got it right, you know. But with time, and I think after Kabanan, a lot started happening.
Right.
And we were able to get, you know, we started seeing different people bringing in equipment and all that. And not too long after that, the industry started really ticking.
Right.
It's not yet there, but it's at least you can get. I can get
true.
Any camera I want
true.
To use to film now.
True.
You know.
True.
But it was a challenge. And
were you ever scared that your dream wouldn't materialize? Because you went out there and decided I'm going to be a trailblazer. You highlighted that you literally offloaded your savings into this vision and this dream. Yeah. Were there nights where you couldn't fall asleep because you were scared?
Yeah. Everything started in Kabanana, you know. I remember the first day that we got it, we got to start shooting. Everything was in place.
Right.
I camped every actor in one house. Oh, you know, like we had tents outside.
Right.
Everybody stayed at the same place.
Right.
Because I was so nervous. I didn't know how it was done in Hollywood, but I said, you're all sleeping here and we've got to make sure
we'll figure it out.
We're going to film and they'll finish at 02 or what. There was a lot of pressure and it was like everybody was
right.
waiting for this
right.
this
right.
this film that this guy is talking about, you know.
Mm.
And I felt the weight upon my shoulders and I got up early in the early hours of the morning on the day of the shoot and everybody, I walked around the camp, everybody was asleep. And I went into the corner in the field and I prayed so hard because I was terrified and
right.
I needed the strength from God to say,
yep.
you know, in order for me to do this, I needed to pray. And I broke down whilst praying. And soon after that, everybody started waking up and there was activity taking place. The guys
right.
doing the set or putting things in place. The crew was putting the equipment ready.
Wow.
And everybody was just waiting for Lawrence Thompson to come and push the button and say, okay, action, you know. The first scene took us the whole day. One scene took us the whole day to shoot because I kept on saying this. I was trying to get it so perfect.
Right.
So the actors
right.
were even getting irritated with me, but I said, I, we've got to get it right.
Do it right, yeah. Don't do it at
yeah.
all.
Yeah. And we shot it for a week. And then the first edit, I looked at it and I said, oh, I messed up things.
Oh,
and we went in again. We fine-tuned it. We tweaked it. I looked at it still again.
Hmm.
And I got the music in and all that. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, this is it.
So you were literally looking to see what had been produced matching the vision that
yes.
you had. And until it was just
right,
right.
That's
you weren't letting it out.
I wasn't letting it out. I was really afraid because... And to tell the truth, even on the day when we were screening it that Friday when I was still tuning it, and we had a big event.
Right.
We invited all the corporate heads and all
right.
that. It was at Intercontinental.
Right.
We sold all the tickets. It was full house, and it was my big night. But I wasn't even on the high table. For some reason, something happened, and I was pushed just in the audience. I remember my mom asking me because she came with me to the opening.
Yeah.
And she says, I thought it was your project. How come
yours?
You're sitting?
why are we out here in the audience? Oh, wow.
Yeah. But anyway, I sat there and they started running. I wasn't watching the film. I was watching people's faces.
Reactions.
The reactions.
You wanted to see. Yes.
Yeah. And at first, there was just like a general laughter, like, you know, all over.
Right.
That broke the ice, at least for me, because I was so scared. I was saying, they're not reacting.
Exactly.
And there was a scene where Robbie or somebody was in hospital and he says, they beat me, bosses. And when they said bosses,
everybody
burst out
because
like,
they could relate.
And then people started, and then they started enjoying it. At the end of the film, everybody stood up and it was a standing ovation.
Fantastic.
And I just sat there It was emotional, and you know, I was so happy that at least we did it.
That it was worth the effort. So I'm sure in that moment there was a lot of validation that happened.
We're going to give you I think it was 1.5 billion at the time
before rebasing. Yes. Yeah,
and I said, "Wow, we did." You know, it was exciting.
Something that you can believe in.
Yeah,
amazing. Amazing. Fast forward from that all the way through to what became an amazing cultural experience for all of us when you finally did something for Netflix.
Yeah.
And the movie broke and we sat up and said, wow,
this
is a Zambian story told for Zambia by Zambians with Zambian actors and shot right here in Zambia. What do you think that did for the industry, and what did it do for you as well? How did it make you feel?
It was a journey, because I went with John. I traveled with John Chitty to Chama, and he started telling me his life, and I was like, wow. You know, I had a friend who was a person living with albinism,
right?
And I remember, you know, whenever I'd go play with him, I'd first spit on
shit.
Because I was told, if you don't spit, it's going to come on you.
Jump on you, yes.
So I always remembered, oh, I didn't spit. And then I spit. And then I say, Friday. His name was Friday.
Oh, wow.
And when I heard John telling me the story about his life, and I thought of Friday, it sort of like it got me, you know, feeling like, you know, this is such a sad story, you know?
True.
And we drove, and I told him, I said, you know, John, this story, your story, I'm going to combine it with the various stories that I've done,
right,
and I'm going to write this thing. And I came back. I don't think he believed I was going to do anything about it.
Really?
But I was really determined, and I wrote the script in one day, and I started now going around trying to get the funding. It was so hard. And so discouraging sometimes and stuff like that. But I met somebody and through Dora Celia,
right,
she got introduced me to this guy. He said, I can give him 5 minutes to hear him out. I didn't know whether he wanted the film or not, but he said, give me 5 minutes.
5 minutes, that's all he was giving you.
And then when I sat with him and I explained to him the story, and he says, I love the story. Instead of 5 minutes, I stayed there 2 hours explaining it to him.
Brilliant.
And he said, we're doing this thing, and I owe him a lot. I'm not going to mention his name just because I'm, you know.
Right. No, fully understood. Privacy.
But he then said, I'll give you the money you need for this film.
Wow.
And when that money came, I said, I've got to look for the best person
best team
to make this film.
Right.
And that's how I started hunting around, and I bumped into Kenny Rock.
Kenny.
And I said to Kenny, I've got a film I want you to do. And I know Kenny's work as a television commercial person. And of course, it was a risk to give somebody who does television commercials, but I felt that if I wanted to get it to the quality that I needed, I needed to have somebody who understands filmmaking to that level. And I know I didn't make a mistake, because the film actually came out there. And finally, we got into a deal, and the film was done. And when we wanted to premiere it, I don't know if you were at the premiere at
Circuit Hall.
Yeah, with the president
who was
there and all
that. Yes.
But before that, you know, the original name for Can You See Us was Mwavi.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't realize it was offensive to people living with albinism. And when they came, they said, no, you can't use that name. If we're going to use that name, we're coming to protest right at the thing.
Oh.
So I tried to convince him and said, listen, if it's a sore point, go anywhere in the streets, people will say Mwavi. That's what they'll say. So this might be the best way to actually deal with this issue, you know, and create awareness on the fact that it's not a good
term. It's derogatory.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I tried to argue them, and they wouldn't hear. No. And you see, the film was already done, and on the title, the opening title, it was Mwavi. Do you go back to the thing?
Say, no, that was just a working title.
Yeah.
We're back. Here's the real title.
Yeah. So we got lawyers. We got we got people from the handicap. We sat and we were going back and forth until we came to a compromise. I said, listen, we've made the film already, and the title is Mwavi. So for this event, we're going to show it as Mwavi.
Yes.
But trust me, we're going to change it later on. And that's how we came to it. And and that's how we were able to screen it on the actual day. So it's quite a journey.
That is an interesting
and
journey.
It still is a journey, to be honest with you, because there's so many challenges, which obviously you don't talk about, but there have been so many problems in it and stuff like that. Even up to now, I'm still having some challenges. But people keep on saying, it's fantastic. It is a fantastic movie, but it comes with challenges.
True.
So when you're young, going out there to do films, you have to go there with an open mind, prepared for some of the challenges that you're going to come across.
True.
It's not all smooth sailing.
And what is it like collaborating with Kenny? You mentioned Kenny Rock, and he's basically a representation of the new school of filmmakers.
Yeah.
And what was it like to combine your years of experience and your knowledge and then what he brought in? So you saw his visuals on his commercials and said, that's interesting. There's a cinematic feel that he's got that would translate.
Yeah.
What was that process like? Was it a partnership? Were you banging heads? We're keen to just be a fly on the wall in some of the production conversations.
I respect Kenny a lot.
Mm.
And I think he's very, very talented. And that's the reason why I actually chose to work with him.
Right.
And he's a wonderful person. We never really bumped heads on the production because I gave him creative freedom on it. I wasn't on the set and pushing him. There's only maybe one or two things where I said, you have to do this or you have to do that.
Right.
But you see, I think because I'm also a creative and sitting there, it wouldn't have been helpful if I sat on the set with him to do it.
Right.
And his wife also was a very good producer on it, so they did a fantastic job, and I left it to them to do it. At the end of the day, you know, when somebody delivers to your expectations, you know, all you can say is good things about them.
And would you say, or do you feel that movie, Can You See Us, has opened doors for Zambian filmmakers? And is it something that you feel people say yes? Because of that, I believe I can go out and do it as well.
I hope it inspires young people to say that we can also do it.
Right.
And it does. It has opened doors. It's up to the individuals now to say, take advantage of this open window. Let's go out there and try to do it, because we've got the exposure now. I mean, I'm talking to Hollywood. I'm talking to Cannes film festivals. And I'm dealing with people. I mean, if you the experience I'm having from the film is amazing. From the business aspect of film, it's amazing what I'm exposed to now.
Right.
The contracts which I'm looking at, the legal things. I'm actually in a legal situation with one of my projects with quite a big international investor.
Right.
Because I felt, he didn't handle this project which I want to do. I'm doing a project. You'll be hearing about it soon.
Oh, great.
But it's because of Kapanana that's opening all these doors. And for me now, making films is not just about screen it in Zambia. It's about how do I distribute it globally?
Yes.
And after Can You See Us, the next project, again, we're also going on the international circuit.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
Yeah, so I'm sure if the young people see it and they take advantage, because it's good productions which are out there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I know every person who scores any level of success enjoys smooth sailing until they hit that brick wall known as imposter syndrome. Have you ever been afflicted by imposter syndrome? Obviously, at some point, you begin to think, have I just fluked my way through this? Or am I really supposed to be here? Is this success really mine? And at some point, you just start to say to yourself, maybe I'm not really best suited for this. Did it hit you at any point?
Yeah, it did earlier on with some of the projects which I did, and I thought like this is a fluke and things like that. But then after so much experience, you become more intentional.
Right.
Yeah. By the time of Can You See Us, I knew it was going to be on Netflix. I knew it was going to be a hit, and I knew it was going to be great. But before then, I used to have the imposter syndrome. I thought, I mean, even let me say Kabanana could be one of those where I thought that, no, this is not me. It's just a fluke, especially when people were commenting. I don't know if you also saw some of the reports. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were in the scene at that time, but some of the reports were saying Kabanana goes bananas, you know? And I'm like, yeah, maybe it's just a chance that this happened. Mm. But every time that we continued to progress, people started respecting it.
Correct.
And even the people were commenting negative about it, wanted to be a part of it, and so on. So the confidence started building from there. And then after that, I think I became more intentional.
Right. You know, an old and wise adage says, do what you love and you'll never have to work a single day in your life. Yeah. Do you find this to be true?
Yes. I love what I do, but there's still challenges.
Exactly. What are those headaches?
It's always about the money. You know, one thing, the danger with running with passion is that you think everybody else around you's got the passion.
You think it's contagious. Yeah.
Until they start, the true head pops it. I mean, the true thing pops its head where people say, I want to be paid. You know, because when you're passionate, you just say, let's do, and so on.
That's it.
And you're going so much, but the bills are actually accumulating.
True.
And now when it comes to paying, and you see the results are not the returns are not coming as sweet as you expected them
exactly.
to be. Because you are driven by passion only. And
true.
You thought everybody in your team was with passion. And then you find that there's a bit of tension which comes in.
Exactly.
And that has been the biggest challenge. You're thinking that actors are just, you know, they're happy to be on screen. We're going together and so on. But it wisens you up a bit when they start.
Reality check brings you back to earth. And so I know for a fact that a person who is well-versed in a particular craft then loses their, for lack of a better word, innocence as far as that craft goes.
Yeah.
How do you watch movies? Do you actually just sit and just enjoy a movie, or is your mind working and saying, that angle's off? Okay, is that camera a shake?
I only have a problem with Zambian productions.
Mm.
I can't help but watch them critically because I feel that I'd like the productions to, you know, to get to a better level. Mm. And there's a tendency of a lot of young people just rushing in to do it without doing anything. And sometimes when I watch the productions, I get a bit, I feel, you know, they should have put more. So I try to avoid watching local productions.
Right.
And many people expect that I have to watch all the productions and they check with me, what did you
True.
Think of it?
True.
And I don't want to lie. So I say, I didn't watch it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
When I watch a good movie, I really enjoy it. And the Zambian movies, which I thought were fantastic, I watched them, the one by Paul, you know, Maria Cristo.
Right.
I was able to watch it and enjoy it and appreciate it and tell him it's a fantastic movie. Oh. But there are a lot of others which I think that, you know, I'd rather not watch them because I'm gonna be too critical watching them. And it's not in a negative way.
No.
Because I think I was attacked with my films and discouraged me quite a bit when I was young. I mean, somebody told me even if it was the last film, I wouldn't spend a penny on it.
Wow.
And this was in front of an international audience, a documentary I did. So I know how painful it is. And I wouldn't want to be honest.
Yeah, that brutally honest. So temper that honesty. Yeah. Wrap it in some velvet.
Yeah, because I think the effort is important. Once the effort is there, that's what is good. But they need to take a bit more thought behind making the films instead of rushing into
it. Right. And besides film, which other art forms inspire you?
I think writing.
Right.
I am writing a book, about my experience, about my life. So they'll also come out there, because I think I have an interesting life.
Yes, indeed. We want to see that biopic.
Yeah.
And just to ask, if you had the opportunity to be part of your own biopic, whom would you cast to play you?
Kamuze.
I'm honored. I was fishing for that.
To be honest, I haven't really thought about it.
Speaking of the mind going, I know creatives just never stop being creative. Yeah. But at some point you need to recharge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just stop and catch your breath. What do you do to recharge? Any rituals, any hobbies away from creative writing, away from film? What do you do to just bring the batteries back up?
My son is on me for that. He's trying to get, you know, I think the last couple of days have made me realize we've been having a conversation about, you know, you've been just
work.
Why don't you do something for yourself, something that you enjoy?
True.
I bought me a fishing rod, and he says, "We're going fishing."
Ah, nice.
So I'm gonna try this. I'm gonna try the fishing and see what it does. But you see, the hardest thing is that, you know, you need to get your funding right. I've got two projects which I have to do. Which
right.
One is a passion project, and the other one is it's a story which needs to be told.
Right.
And I've been trying to push those and try to get the right type of funding for it, because, you know, you can't just, you don't rush into doing a film and you don't have the proper funding.
Right.
So that is what has been preoccupying my mind. And I've had this challenge with, you know, I went to Cannes Film Festival trying to get the funding and all that. And this investor said he was going to do it. And I've been just going back and forth.
Oh.
I found American producers and were about to start doing it. And, you know, there's so many challenges you come across. So it's been keeping me quite a bit. But I think my wife has gone for a while. She's, you know, she's gone to see her sister in the States. So I've got this time to really, like, find myself, go fishing with my son, and maybe...
Please go fishing. Please. And when you go fishing, leave your camera. Don't start filming. Oh, these fish are indigenous to Zambia. No, we don't want a documentary. Just go out there and just enjoy breathing fresh air and just relaxing. Just unplug. Yeah. Unplug. Yeah, and as we wind up, so... is there anything about you that people might be surprised to learn? People just know you in a professional way and on the professional front.
Yeah.
Anything that would surprise someone?
I don't know. Okay, the people will know me, but I think a lot of people will be surprised that I'm a born again, staunch Christian, and because I don't talk much about it.
Hmm.
So maybe that would be something that people don't know about me, that a tongue speaking Christian.
There we go. But just live it out and use your creativity to tell that story.
Yeah.
Amazing. This is a philosophical question, but one that I think we all have to answer at some point. When all is said and done, your final chapter is written, what would you like to be remembered for? And what would be your epitaph? What would we say?
That's a tough one.
It is. It gets you thinking.
You know, it's easy to say, he was the great filmmaker, or much, but I don't know if that is what I'd want to be left. I think it should be something about humility. He was a humble man. Who loved God, probably. That's how I'd like to be remembered. And he ran a good race. And did good things for humanity.
I think that sums it up really well. Yeah. And yes, we can testify. You are a good man who is running a good race. And I think the one thing that people don't realize is how you always make time for people. You always have time to be courteous and stop to actually say a genuine hello and not a brushed alongside, hi, how are you doing? It's, you generally find out, how are you doing? How are things? It's good to see you. Hey, listen, I'm running into a meeting, but it was wonderful to see you. And that means a whole lot to a lot of people, myself included. And that's why I was really excited when I heard that you were coming on to Nkwazi Unfiltered. And it's been wonderful chatting with you. We now know a little bit more about you than we knew before, and we're all the richer and better for it. Thank you so very much.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you, Kamisa.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
And cut. I guess that's an appropriate way to end this episode of Nkwazi Unfiltered. We've been speaking to a man who is all things filmmaking and has been a part of the story of Zambian filmmaking through and through, from inception to being a pioneer and a trailblazer. And he has enriched this industry and allowed people to believe that it can actually be done. And so if you're in doubt, be sure to just scrub all the way back to the beginning and watch this episode where we've been talking to Mr. Lawrence Thompson, filmmaker extraordinaire. Catch you in the next episode of Nkwazi Unfiltered. My name is Kamisa Chikula. Goodbye for now. There's no us without you, so we